Hello, everybody. This is the Gingerbread Man, and I'd like to welcome you to my home. I'm glad to have you here tonight. We're here to discuss some really interesting topics that are very dear to my heart. Tonight, we're going to be discussing Greece. Greece has an ancient history. According to Wikipedia, the Greek Dark Ages started at the end of the Mycenaean palatial civilization at roughly 1100 BC and ending around 750 BC, going into archaic Greece, which ended with the Persian invasion. And classical Greece getting its start with its autonomy and when Greece was able to start its own decision-making for itself as a society. So, almost 1,000 years here, and I really don't understand what was going on and why. But tonight we're going to be discussing a 200-year period between 510 BC and 323 BC, known as Classical Greece. So, this is the peak of democracy in Athens. These two centuries had a huge impact on later Roman empires and the theater, literature, art, and philosophy of the Western world that we have now, in the present. All of this was built upon the backbones of this incredibly special moment in history. So, my philosophical journey began loosely in childhood, hearing about Eastern philosophies such as Buddhism, you know, from some of my father's friends, being exposed to Christianity, the church, though organized, is based upon a Christian philosophy. And Jesus, the man, was a philosopher. And I would argue that he was a cynic. He was a very cynic philosopher. So, we're going to be discussing three men today: Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle. Socrates is my spirit animal. He was born 470 BC. He was a very foolish character. You know, he was very dirty. Just Google a picture of what he might have looked like, you know. He had a family. He didn't work, though, so it's arguable who was making the bills for him. He had this form of speech that was called the dialectic, which was a Q&A format, a question-answer format. So he would go out and he would question and talk to prominent figures of society. And this means politicians, this means theists, this means army soldiers, generals, commanders, what have you. You talk to anybody and everybody, but he loved to talk to people that had influence and import. So he discusses these things he likes to call virtues, and there's the one crucial virtue, which is knowledge. So the one crucial virtue, and he does this thing over and over again that I see through many of his dialogues, where he'll ask a partner, you know, like, what is virtuous? What do you consider virtuous? You know, and people will say, like, oh, the good. You know, I'm like, oh, what's good? You know, what makes something a good thing? And through question and answer, he would boil it down, and eventually, no matter what virtuous element somebody would give him, he would transmute it into knowledge. For instance, the good. What is a good act? You know? Like, well, it depends on its intent and on the action that was done. Why did you comport that act? What made it a good act is the way you reacted to it. And a reaction requires wisdom. And to be wise about something and to know the outcome is to have knowledge. So that's kind of his little system where it boils into it. These virtues were very important to Socrates because knowledge was very important. This principle of what knowledge is and the seeking of it and the curiosity of it. And to be curious for knowledge, you have to question and you have to go question things. And he was trying to, I feel that he was trying to promote this curiosity in people. So the first dialogue that I ever read, and so I guess I should say, Socrates, he never wrote anything down. If anything, he had something, a crucial thing that he was against writing. I think it was the imitation of it. It's because writing was an imitation, because we were imitating something. The imitation of the actual event made it a bastardization, so it was false. So writing something down was pointless. So most of what we know about Socrates is actually from the writings of people who witnessed him, such as Plato. And Plato was a prolific writer. So these Platonic dialogues of Socrates. In the Apology, which I guess I will give a good little excerpt. Real quick, I hope. This Inquisition has led to my having many enemies of the worst and most dangerous kind, and has given occasion also to many calumnies, and I am called wise, for my hearers always imagine that I myself possess the wisdom which I find wanting in others. But the truth is, O men of Athens, that God only is wise, and by his answer he intends to show that the wisdom of men is worth little or nothing. He is not speaking of Socrates. He is only using my name by the way of illustration, as if he said, he, O men, is the wisest who, like Socrates, knows that his wisdom is worth true nothing. And so I go about the world, obedient to the God, and search and make inquiry into the wisdom of anyone, whether citizen or stranger, who appears to be wise. And if he is not wise, then in vindication of the oracle, I show him that he is not wise, and my occupation quite absorbs me. And I have no time to give either to any public matter of interest or to any concern of my own, but I am utter poverty by reason of my devotion to the God. So the God he is mentioning here is wisdom, knowledge. And he makes a funny point here, because there's a myth that Socrates goes to the Oracle of Delphi, and while at the Oracle of Delphi tells him that he is the wisest man in the world, and Socrates goes, impossible. And so that's the joke of why he starts and goes and talks to these people, because he's going to talk to people who are really smart people. He's trying to find the smartest people so that he can find somebody smarter than him. And the joke is, at the end of the day, every person he talks to, nobody's ever smarter than he is. So, it's quite a character. You know, and through his apology, you know, he's constantly bringing up all of his persecutors, all of his prosecutors, all these people who are pushing on, and he is representing himself upon the stand. You know, he is talking for himself. The apology is this very long-winded speech where he's basically making his point for why he didn't do anything wrong. It's the opposite of an apology. And by the end of it, he gets to the end, and it's hilarious, because he's like, oh, I get that you say that I was treasonous. I know you say that I'm against your state. I know, I get it. I know that I've been talking to all your sons, and all of your young boys are just crowding around me. And I know you say that I'm impious. I know, I get it, you have all these allegations to me, but, hear me out, man, just wait. What if you paid me for the rest of my life, and we can just forget this ever happened? Right, what tomfoolery is that? Like, it's incredible, the balls. And that's basically how the apology ends. Like, that's the balls in this man. So in another dialogue, it's called the Credo, Socrates wakes, and he's already been sentenced, and he's sitting in his cell, and he wakes, and a good friend of his, Credo, an even older man than him, is sitting and just sobbing. And he's like, Credo, how did you even get into this room? Did the guards let you in? And Credo goes, oh, the guards have seen me come in here so many times to see you that they don't care anymore. Like, it's so melodramatic. And so Socrates is like, well, what's wrong? Why are you upset? What's going on? He's like, well, don't you know you're going to give your life soon? And Socrates just laughs it off. He's like, oh, we all have lives to give. Mine has to come at some day. Why not now? Like, he's so cool about it. So Credo just gets on, and he's like, hey, You know, like, we can get you out of here. We can spirit you away. The guards like you. They won't even keep us. We can take you away. We can get you out to another city. You know, we can get you, like, Thebes or something. Like, and Socrates is well aware of this. He knows that it's well within their power to take him to Thebes if that's what they want to do. But he doesn't want to go. And so his arguments are, there's public opinion. You know, like, what do the people think? You have people who look up to you. What are they going to say when you die? What about your family? What about your children they look up to? What are they going to say when you die? And Socrates basically compares his family to the people of Athens. The city of Athens is he's like, this is my city. You know, I love my people. I love everybody here, you know? Like, the city of Athens has said that I need to die. And because I love my people as much as I would love my father, you know, I won't go against what she says. That's why he's willing to die, is because he loves his people so much. And to stand by his principles, even when his people say he must die, he's willing to do that. You know, how many people are willing to die for their principles? A principle of truth, of something that you have a conviction and that you hold. Who's really willing to die for that? Galileo didn't. Galileo wasn't willing to stand up to the Inquisition and give his life for his model of the solar system. He bowed and he sat in house arrest. But Socrates, he gave the last thing that you can give. He gave his life for a principle of truth, to stand for curiosity, because he felt that what he was doing was the right thing, and he thought that he was helping people. I can't not feel that that's why he was willing to give his life up. It was because of love for his people, and because he knew that all he was doing was the right thing. He knew in his heart that it was the right thing. That's a very admirable thing to give your life for. I'm not sure I'm that strong. On a less heavy note, there's another section. I'd like you to look up this diagram, because I was considering writing it down and trying to say it out loud, but that would be impossible to make it in any feasible way that'd be understandable. So Meno's box analogy. So the heart of what Socrates is trying to do in this situation is he goes and he finds this army commander, this man named Meno, and Meno and him are having this argument where Socrates has this belief that we don't learn anything, that we really recollect all of our memories, and that when we're born as infants, we're born with every bit of knowledge that is capable of being known on the planet, and that in the process of learning, we're selectively remembering the pieces that are brought into our focus. And so he shows this by having Meno bring over one of his little cadets, lieutenants, whatever you want those people are called. And so he starts questioning the boy, and it's like a 6-page dialogue where he basically, through questioning the boy, teaches the boy how to find a diagonal inside of a square or something, which is like a little tricky. It's like it's algebra, you know? And like, and it's very obvious Socrates doesn't give him anything the whole time, and the boy ends up with the answer at the end, you know. And it's arguable whether human intuition is just that strong, and whether we are all built with very similar pieces of equipment that put together Lego pieces in fantastic ways. And when you approach somebody with a similar scenario, we're going to put those pieces together very similarly. And what Socrates was really witnessing was the power of our intuition and our deductive ability to connect dots within our brain abstractly. And that we don't have to hold things, we don't have to measure things and have one and one in our hand. We can still deduce things if you give us that situation. And I think that's what was happening with Meno's little soldier. So Plato is born 429 BC. He dies 348. He writes a bunch of plays. He starts an academy, which is basically the framework for what will become all, like, institutional learning, like our universities we have nowadays. The college systems that we have are based upon this one epitome of a school. And in this academy, you know, Plato's teaching, he carries the baton from Socrates, you know, like he carries it in a way that many of the other contemporaries of Socrates, many of the other young boys, you know, like Antisthenes would have been another of the boys with Plato who were watching Socrates. And then Antisthenes was the teacher of Diogenes, and Diogenes is the cynical school. And so Plato takes it and just, maybe it's his esteem, maybe it's his wealth. I'm not sure. I know that he fought in the war just like Socrates did. Socrates was a war hero, which might have been where he got his esteem as well. So Plato comes back and he starts this academy. And it fucking pops off. And it has a huge impact. And I'd like to tell one of my favorite stories now. It's called Plato's Cave. I think I might have told it before, but it's one of my favorite ones. I think it's worth telling it again. You're in a dark cave. You're sitting on the floor with your head and back held against the wall with an iron manacle around your neck, holding your neck erect so you cannot bend that much, and it's even hard to see the people to your left and to your right. Everybody that's on the cave walls next to you are in the same exact situation, and you've grown up with all these people staring at the walls in the same exact position. Across the wall is lit up, and there's silhouettes, shadows, that dance across the wall, left to right, back and forth. Many different shapes, many different forms, many different patterns in the way that they come out. And the people that sit with you, manacled, watching the walls, all talk about these figures as they go, and they start to classify them. The people who are quickly able to identify the forms and who are quickly able to recognize patterns are given special esteem along the wall of prisoners, especially fearsome sight. Now imagine somebody were to walk down the stairs and unshackle you and start to walk you up so that you could see the fire and you could see the people standing in front of the fire lifting pieces of paper cut in different shapes, parading them back and forth for the prisoners below to see. You walk further up, and you start to see the entrance to the cave in a bright, bright light. And as you're led outside, your entire eyes are just blown out by just the sheer force of so much light that has never been touching your body before. You run back inside the cave shrieking. So would I. But then again, you're let out. And slowly somebody teaches you all the different shapes and all the different forms that are around you. And they start to teach you the colors, and they start to teach you all the life and all the different things that are around. They teach you the stars. They teach you how to tell the time of day. They teach you how to tell the seasons, how to farm, how to do all the activities, all these things that are off of that wall. Would you go back? Would you try to take more people with you? Would you try to unshackle the people who are your fellow cavemates and try to lead them back up, even though you know it would make them afraid at first? How do you think they would respond? Do you think they would respond happily? Or do you think they might try to hurt you because you're mad? Now, this is an allegory, and it could be taken many different ways. And another take I've even heard that I especially liked was that when you're led outside of the cave and you see the world for what it is, maybe that's just another cave, and that there's an additional staircase that needs to be climbed, and that it might be caves and caves and caves like an onion. So this is alluding to this concept of Plato's forms. So a form is the basis for a thing. Like, there's many different types of trees, You know, there's trees that have cherries. There's trees that have purple leaves. You know, there's all kinds of different pretty beautiful trees out there. All different types of plant life and all different types of rainforest trees. There's little trees, big trees. I don't know. All kinds of fucking trees. My point is that for Plato, there is a form of a perfect tree. The perfect tree. Like, what would that be? Would that be an amalgamation of all the trees on the planet? Like, that's how abstract this principle of a form is, because a form is not sensible. Because all the trees we've seen, we've sensed with our eyes, we've felt with our hands, we've smelt them with our noses, we've heard the wind go through the leaves as they bristle, or the snow fall as they fall out of their branches. But all these are sensible objects. You see what I'm saying? The form of the perfect form isn't sensible. It's something that only exists in the mind's eye. It's a concept. Now, what about justice? What's the form of justice? What's perfect justice? I don't think any human on the planet has a moral code strong enough to even understand what justice is. What is beauty? What is perfect beauty? When we sense something beautiful, that feeling, is that feeling a connection with the form of beauty? So Plato did a lot of traveling. He traveled to countries such as Italy and to Egypt. And Egypt is major. Egypt is a center of intellectual study, of mystery schools, of mysticism, of occultism, of science, math, whatever, what have you. And Egypt is under-respected because it's a dust bowl now. But I have strong feelings that Egypt has had many civilizations. The Egypt that's talked about in the Torah, that's 5,000, 6,000 BC. You know, that's 8,000 years ago. Like, that's incredible how much time. Like, ancient Egypt is so long ago. And they were still peopling, and they were still kicking ass, and they were still doing their thing very well. So Britannica's website, which I used for some of the bio information for these guys, including their birth dates and stuff like that, had this interesting piece where they had this beautiful picture that I just oohed and aahed about, and I just thought it was so cool just to be able to see it real quick. And it was just a scrap with holes in it, like, and it's just eroding, and you could see Greek letters on it, and it was the original Phaedo that is transcribed over and over and over again. And they're basically talking about, well, not the original, of course, but what they're talking about is how hard it is to keep some of these things well. And when you're transferring things, the habit was to copy them down. So you'd have the original script, and then you'd copy it, and then it would get copied and copied and copied. And not even just to make copies to have copies, but sometimes just to keep it going, because the original copy you had is deteriorating, so you have to write it down again so you don't lose it. Or just be restricted to word of mouth, which was a thing. You know, word of mouth is a big deal. For most of society, most of our myths were word of mouth. So that shows you how strong a myth can be, that it's still firmly embedded into our subconscious now. So every time it's copied and copied and copied, you have corruptions of the original vernacular and the original word choice used. So what's funny is, and you end up having translations or these copies in one area that'll be very different from the copy that had been made for several centuries in a different area. So you have this huge variance that I've also witnessed in translations. When you're translating from language to language, you lose things when you copy. You know, every time, even in, yeah. So I guess that's the point of being a good teacher, is trying to get across as much of the heart of the information as physically possible in the best way. That's something I hope I do when I'm communicating some of these ideas, because these ideas are very important to me, and I hope I do them justice so that they get across and I don't distort them or corrupt them. All right, off to Aristotle. So Aristotle was a teacher and he was a scientist. He was born in 384 BC until he died in 322 BC. He started his own little school he called the Lyceum. He was born in a place called Macedonia, which was part of northern Greece at the time. It was its own country and settlement at another time. His father was named Nicomachus, and he was a court physician, so he was a doctor. And so Nicomachus was the doctor for Philip the Great, which is the king of Macedon, and he happened to be Alexander the Great's father. Yep, Philip is Alexander's daddy. So he ended up teaching Alexander for 3 years, from 343 to 340 BC, which is only like, it's not that much time. You know, of course, so a lot of these relationships between these guys were over enunciated. You know, at least the way I saw it, I always thought that Socrates, Aristotle, and Plato were hanging out, and that Aristotle was most likely on war campaigns with Alexander. Like, while Alexander was riding the elephants with the big old fucking elephant spears, like, I always thought Aristotle was, like, back, like, writing math problems back at the tent, you know, but that's not how it is. He taught him when he was a very small child, and then he probably got his ass kicked out, because he was probably a really good teacher, and Alexander was probably a spoiled brat. So, yeah. Again, Plato and Socrates. Socrates is a much older man. Plato was probably about 30 when Socrates was at trial. So, you know, 20 to 30 is not a child. I call them boys, but, you know, it's just because Athens had this trend of boy loving. You know, like, it was very normal for the especially esteemed men in society to go find younger proteges and to teach them, including sexually. Like, sodomy was a normal thing, and bisexuality especially was heavily considered normal. And I am apt to think that it is pretty normal. Like, as long as it's not like children, not like 12, 13, 14 year olds. But if you got a 20 year old dude and they feel comfortable being with a 50 year old dude or even a 50 year old woman, you know, at that point it's pretty consensual. You know, I don't like, but in this society, it was very normalized, you know. So that's why I've been calling them boys the whole time, because I think it's funny, you know, especially with Socrates' bend. He'd get crushes on the pretty guys in Athens, and he was notorious for it. So Plato's one of these younger men who had been following Socrates around. He's 30 when Socrates dies, you know. So Plato starts the academy soon after, you know, still. Aristotle attends the academy in Plato's last 20 years of life. So it's very unlikely that Aristotle was a direct contemporary of Plato at this time. And it's much more likely that Plato is most likely, a lot of most likelies there, but Plato is traveling, you know, not directly in the seat at this point, though Aristotle made huge waves when he entered his school. So Aristotle had a huge fucking just breadth. He was known for adding things to biology, botany, chemistry, ethics, history, logic, metaphysics, rhetoric, philosophy of mind, philosophy of science, physics, poetry, political theory, psych, zoology, founder. Yeah, oh yeah. So he was the founder of zoology. Like, hardly anybody considered animals anatomically even like similar to humans to even be worth a damn. And Aristotle was huge on dissection. So he was probably that creepy kid that you worried was going to be a serial killer. Like, he dissected a shit ton of animals, including a bunch of bugs. Like, he was the guy who did pen boards with like flies and butterflies and shit. Like, so he had a huge impact on this field and is most likely the founder and starter of it. And one of my favorite things that I always remember coming out of Aristotle's sort of fucking, he wanted to say that it was impossible for anybody to not be a philosophizer. So philosophy is the love of knowledge, the love of learning knowledge, the love of learning, the love of wanting to know why, the love of seeking, you know. And so he would say that to argue against the point of philosophy, to argue that there's a point. Like, a lot of the times when you're a daydreamer, I've been approached in the way of like, why are you examining this? Why do you care? Why are you asking these questions? Why are you digging this deep? Why does it matter to you? You know, like, and so that's arguing it's the point of philosophy. Why are you philosophizing? Why are you giving a shit? Why do you care? But to argue against the point of philosophy, to argue that there is a point of asking why and why not just do it, is itself a philosophy. That is a way of being. It is a way of knowing. It's a way of living. It is a philosophy, which I just, incredible. But Aristotle, he talks about predicates. So again, predicates are a relation between things. You know, a plant's leaves are predicated to its roots. It's very rare for a leaf to be completely autonomous. I'm sure maybe it does happen. Even as I say it, I'm sure there's probably some like leaf plant out there, some tumbleweed that doesn't need any roots. A guitar's tone is predicated to its string and its form, the way that the string is on there, you know. Purpose. Aristotle was big on what was called teleology. I can never say it. Teleology? Anyways, so everything has purposes. Everything lives for an end. You know, so the purpose of a human is to think and to eat and to survive and to procreate. We have all these purposes, these ends that are imbued into our lives that we're living for, that we're doing for. You know? This is the teleological means. And so everything has a purpose. Even the ground might have the purpose to have plants in it. You know, so when you're looking into, it's a very cause and effectual way to look at the world, I would say. And the different types of souls, I think, with something that'd be very Aristotelian, whereas you have the primal soul, you know, it's kind of like the red base root chakra, you know, fight or fuck. Then you have the vegetative soul, which is like the plant, you know, it has life, it's growing, but it doesn't seem to have motion or action. Then you have the animalistic soul, which is the animal soul, which eats, has action, has movement, has life, but it doesn't seem to have thought, which I disagree with. And then you have the fully conscious soul, or the formal soul, the formal purpose or whatever, you know, which is the human soul, the human brain that has the thoughts, that the real important thoughts. Maybe, I don't know. Maybe a tree's thought is far more important than our thoughts. Has anybody ever considered that? I've often been very envious when I look at a giant oak tree and all that it gives to its environment, while as we seem to take so much. Why would we be superior to the tree when the tree is doing so much more than we are? We might be doing things for ourselves. We might be doing things for our comfort, so we can make electricity, have our creature comforts, and have access to whatever foods we want, so we can drive our cars to our jobs. But that tree just sits there all day long making things for the world. It makes air. It makes nutrients. It trades nutrients with other plants. It acts as a hub for its entire ecosystem. Makes me feel very alienated as a little walking human sometimes. But that's okay. So I would like to mention that Socrates and these guys, Socrates starting this, was so important that basically everybody before Socrates is considered pre-Socratic. Like, it's like BC with Christ. And I know it's BCE now, before Common Era, but it's like, it's, he had a huge impact on the way of thinking. And I think he got a lot. I see a lot of very Stoic roots coming from Zeno. You know, Zeno's Stoa Poleika, which was this common central meeting place of people where they could have conversations and arguments, you know, a forum, you know, a physical forum for people to talk, which is something we're severely lacking nowadays. You know, I see influences of the Stoicism in Socrates. He wasn't... There's not a school of thought you can peg on him. You can't peg a tail on this donkey. You can't say he was Stoic. You can't say he was just Socrates. And the only thing that he knew for sure was that he knew nothing at all. All right. Let's see here. You want to see how fucking boring... I don't know. I just have a problem with Aristotle. I respect him and I understand him. I don't understand him. But I try so hard. All right. Here's perfect. This is a bad example. For if these are taken, a syllogism will be formed to prove that A belongs to none of these. For if these are taken, a syllogism will be formed to prove that none of these are E's. Not, however, from all the premises taken, but in the aforesaid mood. For B will belong to all A and not to E. Consequently, B must be identical with one of the H's. Again, if B and G cannot belong to the same thing, it follows that A will not belong to some of the E's. For then, too, we shall have the middle figure, for B will belong to A and as to no G. Consequently, B must be identical with some of the H's, for if the fact that B and G cannot belong to the same thing differs in no way from the fact that B is identical with some of the H's, for that includes everything that cannot belong to E. I want to also say there's not a fucking picture in this whole goddamn book. So it's just him just talking about letters and shit. And he's very difficult for me. Reading Aristotle is like me beating my head into a brick wall repetitively. Here's one that's slightly a little bit more banal. Scientific knowledge is not possible through the act of perception. Even if perception as a faculty is of the such and not merely of a this somewhat, yet one must at any rate actually perceive a this somewhat and at a definite present place and time. But that which is commensurately universal and true in all cases one cannot perceive, since it is not this and it is not now. I like that. So that's showing his bend towards relativity, which... He was very scientific, and any true science is going to be very open-minded to the opposite, to the thing that you do not expect, to the relative. And he's saying that anything that we can measure here and now, when we're talking about it later, it's no longer here and now from then and there. The time situations have changed, so when we even talk about observations, we are stepping out of the sphere of complete objectivity. And life has become relative and subjective, which I fucking love. That's my shit right there. I'd like to end this on a little bit of a lighter note. I have in front of me a play, which I hope to find. I want to get a crew together eventually, a couple people, and I'd like to perform this. And I'd want to do it right, so I want to ask for permission. But it's a play by Aristophanes. Aristophanes is he's Socrates' age. So he's one of the people who's been watching Socrates go around. And before Socrates' death, like most of the material that I've been talking about has been close to his death and afterwards. And Socrates was very idealistic at this point, where there's this massive dualism between the soul and the body. You know, and so he's very woohoo and very spiritual when he's talking about these ideas of abstract knowledge and forms and mystical spiritual forms that you can sense with your mind's eye. Like, these are really strange, up-in-the-air topics. In his younger life, he had a much more natural philosophical bend. And natural philosophy is the science that we consider now. Natural philosophy is any thinking that has to do on natural phenomena. So in ancient worlds, before the technology that we had to actually physically go visit the moon, all of astronomy was pure introspection and thought process. So it's part of the natural philosophy. Physics, why does the volcano blow? We don't have technology to realistically measure and make math about that yet. So it's all thought, you know. And whereas these things that we think of as hard concrete science now was natural philosophy then. And so this, in his younger years, Socrates was really heavy about this, which is one of the reasons why they wanted to put him off as impious and kill him off, was because natural philosophy dares. A lot of natural philosophers, even in ancient Greece, were atheists, and they didn't believe in Zeus and all that, you know. So The Clouds is a comedy which, picture the scene, ancient Greece, you know, these mausoleums that are just expertly built with the beautiful fucking curves that just perfectly bends all this noise in the right places, like really, like these centers, they would gather in these areas for these comedy festivals and these tragedy festivals and all these different artsy festivals, because they didn't have TV. This is how we made money. It was business, and it was also a way for people to spend their time. You know, people also flocked to mass murder and to, fucking to horror places, and they also flocked to mass executions and stuff. But so, you know, people are obsessed with entertainment. So this is much more lighthearted than execution. This is a comedy show. This is where I would be. You know, if I had a time machine, I would be at these comedy shows. I couldn't imagine anything better. You know, I very much enjoyed this book. I thought it was fucking hilarious. I don't care that it's 2,500 years old. It still hits. The comedy's on point. Like, I was amazed picking this up because I didn't think anything would be funny, but it's fucking funny. All right. So this, I want to do it a little bit earlier. Okay. So this is the Coryphios, which is the clouds. So the clouds are, this is the chorus. So, you know, you have the actors and there's a chorus behind them. And so the clouds are the chorus, which is the Coryphios. And so, hail, super annuated man. Hail, old bird dog of culture, to Socrates. And hail to you, O Socrates, high priest of poppycock. Inform us what your wishes are. For of all the polymaths on earth, it is you we most prefer. You and Prodicus, him we love for wisdom's sake. But you, sir, for your swivel eyes, your barefoot swagger, down to the street, because you're poor on your account and terribly affected. Strypsides. Name of earth, what a voice, solemn and holy and awful. Socrates. These are the only gods there are. The rest are but figments. Strypsides. Holy name of earth, Olympian Zeus is a figment? Socrates. Zeus? What Zeus? Nonsense. There is no Zeus. Strypsides. No Zeus? Then who makes it rain? Answer me that. Socrates. Why, the clouds, of course. What's more, the proof is incontrovertible. For instance, have you ever seen rain when you did not see a cloud? So, in this book, Socrates has a school that's called the Thinkery, and it's basically described as this ramshackle hovel. And across the street is Strypsides and Phipsides. Strypsides is an elderly man who has a bunch of debts that he owes. And so he keeps getting more debts because his son Phipsides keeps betting his money on horse races. And he has no job and isn't doing anything. So Strypsides goes across the street to the Thinkery to see if Socrates can teach him some tricks to talk his way out of debts, because he's heard that people have went to Socrates and basically learned sophistry, you know, this idea of sophism, where you can learn how to talk your way out of anything, and because you just, the truth is what you, how you beat it. So Aristophanes is not a fan of Socrates, and so he's painting him in this light that Socrates has when he's on trial. He's being painted as this natural philosopher who is impious and is corrupting the youth. And he's corrupting the youth by teaching them how to just talk their way out of everything. You know, so the Thinkery, when they get over there, it's just a whole bunch of these kids are just super thin, just skin and bones, because nobody has food. And they get inside, and there's paper all over the walls. And Strypsides goes in. He's like, "Where's Socrates?" And a student points up at the walls, and he's like, "Oh, he's up there with his head up in the clouds." And Socrates is up in a basket. And then Strypsides goes, "Why are you in a basket?" And he's like, "The air is clear up here." And he's like 5 feet off the ground. Like, it's just ridiculous. Like, absolutely hilarious. It's just great, great fucking comedy. but it's an excellent commentary that you can see on somebody from the time period commenting on Socrates who isn't a fan of him. Here we go. Socrates, what thoughts have you had? Stripsides, only this. I've been thinking how much of me would be left when the bugs got through. So Stripsides is in a blanket right now. He's been told to sit underneath a blanket until he has a very profound thought. So he's been sitting under the blanket for so long, and the blanket is infested with lice. So Stripsides is now complaining of getting bit by bugs. Socrates goes, bah! Consume you for an ass. Stripsides, I am consumed. Socrates, courage, gaffer. We mustn't repine. Pull back your covers and concentrate. What we need is some clever quibbling subterfuge with which to frustrate your fleece your creditors. Who's fleecing who, Socrates? That's what I'd like to know. Another brief silence follows. I wonder what he's up to now. I'll peek under the covers. He lifts the sheepskin. What's this? Asleep on the job, are you? By Apollo, I'm not sleeping. Any thoughts yet? Not a thing. Surely you found something. Well, only this thing I've gotten in my hand. Buffoon, go back to your pallet and cogitate. But Socrates, what am I cogitating about? A moot question, friend, whose answer lies with you. When you know what you want, kindly illuminate me. But I've told you 10,000 times already, Socrates. It's my debts. I want you to welsh my debts. Splendid. Then back to your pallet. Stripsides dutifully crawls under his sheepskin. And now distill your mind to its airiest essence, allowing the subtle elixirs of thought to permeate and penetrate your pores of the problem. Then analyze, refine, synthesize, define. It's so good. It makes me want to read it again. It has me cracking up. Well, anyways, I know this is a lot of... I find it interesting. I hope you find it interesting. I'm not going to call it boring. It's not boring. I think it's fucking cool. It's very interesting. The reference material that I referenced tonight was The Clouds by Aristophanes. I was reading out of The Basic Works of Aristotle, which was an edition by Richard McKeown. It's one of those Barnes & Noble's classical books. The Dialogues of Plato, Bantam Classics. And that was it. Yeah. All of it was free use, academic comments. You know, absolutely no money's made on the show. I'm not selling anything. Please don't bone me. I just want to have spreading of knowledge, spreading of curiosity. And I hope I do that. Tonight's show was brought to you by your sponsor. I know you know them well. It's brought to you by Old Geezers, Old Dead Dudes. Thank them. Old dead women, too. All those old people. Writing down your thoughts and writing down your words so I can read them thousands of years later. There's so much fucking material that I owe to all these old dead dudes that I hope we keep getting more old dead dudes every day. I don't mean that. Old dead dudes unite. All right. If you made it to this part of the show, all the way to the end. Again, I can't tell you how much I appreciate you. Thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you. I'm so grateful for you. I hope you're grateful for you. I hope you see how valuable you are. And I hope you know that you have thoughts that are very important. And 2,500 years from now, your thoughts could have made a revolution and people could still be thinking about how you influenced an entire system of schools and academies based in bureaucracy and bullshit. Have a wonderful night. Thank you.